it's kind of an interesting swamp thing there too.
Okay, I definitely want to touch on.
He's not draining the swamp because he's not doing his job.
Yeah, we actually got a question, so I solicited some questions. And so what may be a good lead-in on that particular subject is one of these questions, and it was I basically asked, you know, what questions do you guys have? And somebody said, when's he actually going to drain the swamp? So let me see if I can find this real quick. Okay. When is Trump going to start draining it? That was the question. Yeah. There. So I think that'd be a really good lead in.
Let me see if I can find some numbers here.
Another question. What type of mingling actually happens between the politicians and DC and the Fed? We're told it's a separate entity, but it sure seems not to be the case. So he's talking about the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
When is Trump going?
I have an incident I can relate on that to the Federal Reserve governor from Richmond.
Okay.
Through meeting with business people. So.
Yeah. So here, let me read through the questions, and then we'll see if anything jumps out at you here. When is Trump going to do something about censorship? I don't think he should. So we'll not.
No.
That's a huge topic.
I wonder what they mean about it. Are they for it or against it?
Social media censorship is a huge issue with libertarians right now because
it
started with Alex Jones, and then it led to some of the lower tier conspiracy sites getting banned, but now they're banning just basic libertarian mainstream outlets. I will be amazed if my page makes it to 2020, and it's not because we do anything that's even remotely controversial. It is just that Facebook flat out as a business doesn't want politics, and so they're trying to frustrate anybody who does politics on their platform to just stop using it. And so so we're fully expecting to not have a page by 2020, and so it's a huge deal for libertarians because it's freedom of speech. So
you're sort of fading out there, Chris.
Yeah,
you're fading out there, Chris. Let me close some of these extra pages I've got up. Maybe that'll help.
The other thing that can help is if you disconnect your phone from Wi-Fi, because sometimes that's
say that again.
Disconnect your phone from Wi-Fi.
Do what? Do what? Disconnect it.
Yep.
How do I do that? Just turn it off.
Yeah.
Okay, let me do that. That's a good idea.
Yeah, because that's always a secret culprit on these interviews that people don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Another question.
I have a lot of pages open, though, so that's probably also problematic. Let me see. Close a couple. And so, okay, let's see what this one says. I can close that one. I can close that one. Can close that one. No, I just had a good couple numbers here, though. Let's see. Can close. Let me close that one and that one. Oh, you still there?
Yep, I'm here.
Grit?
Yep, can you hear me?
Alrighty. Okay.
So can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay. So yes, they're starting to shut down a libertarian page that shared memes that had like 600,000 likes, and it's arguably the most popular libertarian.
Really?
Yeah. It's a page that is arguably the most.
On what basis?
They didn't give a reason. There was no basis given, and not only did they shut it down, I did an interview with the guys, and now my personal account is on a 30-day ban, and then when the guys restarted their page, that got banned again, And then all of the admins had every page that their accounts were connected to were deleted, including one guy's local Boy Scout troop page. So they are just really like hellbent on making sure that anybody who has any kind of alternative view of the news, which, and I don't mean conspiracy, I mean just an independent way of looking at things. You know, these guys didn't do anything that was even remotely outrageous, and it was the most popular libertarian page, and so libertarians are just on fire right now. You know, and nobody wants to go to
everybody should. You actually should contact the Post about that.
Really? Yeah.
Yes. That makes no sense. And it's like, you know, as you and I both know, people at lower levels get kind of an order. It's like, who will rid me of this damn priest?
Exactly right, yes.
And I think if you said this to somebody like Zuckerberg, he would be stunned. Not that I think he's – I think Zuckerberg's a seriously thoughtful, kind of nice guy. I don't have any conspiracy theories about him, and I have friends who know him well. But I think he has a kind of naivete as well, mm-hmm. about how all this stuff works. And I did see this interesting article this morning about – I forgot it was in – one of my bajillion feeds about how, you know, the web and technology has become sort of the dark web to all of these parents out in Silicon Valley. They're hiring nannies to police their children.
Wow.
so that they can't be on media, the stuff that these people spend their lives, you know, doing. So
I agree with you. I think that Jack and Zuckerberg don't want to be pressured into the position of deciding what is acceptable political speech. I certainly think that, you know,
I think it's right.
I know my voice is certainly acceptable political speech. I know that their voice is, but for them to just say, well, you know, I had a 1-day suspension a couple years ago for a comment or something. It was a legitimate, like, I probably shouldn't oppose to that. But then, you know, the next escalation is usually another 1-day or a 3-day ban. This, I got a 30-day ban right out of the gate. And so I think they're just what they're trying to do. You'll probably see this reported in the next couple weeks. I think what Facebook is doing is they're just anybody who's even remotely questionable, take them off till after the midterms to help their business position. So it is.
And that's sort of understandable. I think also they can't figure it out.
Right.
I mean, I think they're scared to death. And, you know, everybody talks about how great algorithms are, but that's horseshit. I mean, you know, I'm in that business, and I just and I actually know a fair amount about it. And I just think it's almost impossible to do this. And, of course, a lot of that is outsourced to humans in India, you know.
Right.
And you also have cultural differences and everything else. And then, of course, now they're responsible for policing elections in Bangladesh. So give me a break.
Forget it. Yeah, no. And I'm sure, and I know that if I sat down with somebody at the company and said, here's the point that I was trying to make, and I've given these guys thousands of dollars over the years. It just, I don't know. It's very... Yeah. So that's why it's a big deal in the libertarian space, and they're not going to go after... anybody who's they're shutting down a lot of left, right, conservative. I mean, they're shutting down the full spectrum, but I think it's just because they want to eventually erase politics. And if they have news and politics, it will be from preferred partners like the New York Times. And that is inherently pro-government, pro-corporation, not independent in any way, shape, or form. And that's kind of the spirit of these platforms, is that everybody's a publisher. So...
Well, so when that happens, though, see, part of the problem is Zuckerberg really wants to be a utility in many different respects.
Right.
And I've not heard him call it that, but he some years ago said that he wanted to learn from Microsoft and others how to become embedded in everything. And he's been very deliberate about that and making big bets on, you know, alternate technology and approaches. And so if you become a utility, you really have to be a public platform.
Yeah.
So I think there's an inherent contradiction there. So I think a lot of this is fear on their part right now of regulation.
Yeah, no, so. for sure. And it is. It's so as an independent content creator, I have no power. And so, you know, because I have a day job that's social media marketing, I can't risk those clients or those people getting their page banned because I do politics. So I don't even have control of my own Facebook page for this brand because I have to firewall it a little bit. So it is, so I've got to have other people do it. So it's very, it's a very weird position.
Fortunately, I don't have a Facebook page for you to swamp over onto me.
another question here. What's the ratio of lobbyists to elected politicians in DC? Are there any lobbyists for libertarian causes in DC or are they blocked out?
Interesting.
So I think that, so here's what we ought to do.
That's a question I wish I'd had before. We can research that one.
Okay. I can kind of shelve that one. We don't have to ask that today.
I think what we should do is say, you can say we got that question and I can say, well, I don't know, but we can find that one out. That's pretty easy.
Okay.
And we'll come back to you next week.
All right. So let's start with the political violence. We'll talk about the growing independence. We'll talk about midterm predictions. And then I'll ask you the listener's question about the swamp. And we can talk about the Iraq stuff and more control by the swamp. And then those couple questions.
And when you on political violence, I think you can put this back in the context of the swamp, which is, look, you were around in the 60s and 70s and all that. Was it worse then?
That's exactly. Yeah, that's
Are
been
we a, worse.
That's been the number one question that I wanted to talk to you about. So the timing kind of works out, sadly. So, all right. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
This meeting is being recorded.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all the irreverence it deserves. We toss out the screaming heads and put people before political parties and give context to the news to make you think. I'm Chris Spangle, and this is a special series on We Are Libertarians called The Swamp Explained. My co-host for this series is Rob Cortell, a 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C. Rob has worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. He's also been a candidate for Congress and Senate, and given his experience and iconoclastic viewpoints, Rob gives us great insight into the swamp that makes up our nation's capital. We're always taking your questions. We'd love questions at editor@wearelibertarians.com for Rob. If you have questions about how Washington, D.C. works, please send those along. We have a few today that we'll answer. So first and foremost, Rob, how are you doing today?
Doing great. I'm actually today coming to you from the Chesapeake Bay on an island I've been coming to since I was about 5 years old. It's called Gwynn's Island, and it's a very remote part of the bay. The lower western shore of Virginia, about 45 miles from Williamsburg, and I'm sitting out here looking at a lovely scene of water and a few clouds and a nice temperature and dreading the winter.
sounds lovely. Yeah, I have quite the similar view. I have a retention pond out the back door of my house here, so just looking at that lovely view and here on this beautiful Sunday. Well,
fortunately, your retention pond is not down in North Carolina, where a lot of those are pig ponds, and they have all been overwhelmed by the two hurricanes that have come their way in the last couple weeks. So,
yeah, it is the
wind stuff.
I don't know about you. So one of the reasons that I love doing this series and talking to you is that you can give me a perspective that I am surrounded by libertarian millennials. And so I like, you're not a libertarian millennial. You're a libertarian leaning baby boomer, I would say.
But I am, I am a registered Republican, but I don't vote for them all.
Right.
And you have to admit, Chris, in my day life, I hang out with an awful lot of millennial, semi-libertarian, semi-left wingers, et cetera, in the technology industry. So,
yeah, you have a
gives me a good perspective.
Yeah, that's exactly why I like doing the show, is that you give me perspective, because you have the wisdom of age and also the iconoclastic viewpoints. And so, first I'm gonna ask about the weather, and then I'm gonna ask about politics in the 60s specifically. But it seems to me, so my birthday is September 9th, and every year it kind of turns around my birthday. But this year it was in the 90s till almost late October. The weather does, and maybe it is by virtue of climate change, Or maybe it's just the weird cycle that we're in because it goes through these decade cycles that are kind of odd. But it seems to me that the weather is changing from what I knew as a kid. But I don't think I have enough data points to necessarily say if that's true or not.
Hmm.
So what do you think?
Interesting. Non-empirically, the weather is changing, and I see it down here. So I am about 8 feet above sea level, 9 feet above sea level, and my property, as I say, abuts the water. I have about 6 acres here at the end of this island, and I am looking at half of my yard being under a quarter to an inch of water because of the high tides. And we are having more and more high tides than I ever recalled in the early days. And I've been coming to this island, as I had said earlier, for almost probably close to 65 years, almost my entire life. And so, you know, anecdotally, it feels like it's changing. We have had very mild winters. Of course, Washington is on a cusp. This region's on a cusp, so you can never tell. But, you know, empirically, they say it is changing. And I think the week before last, there was an interesting report out of the Trump administration, which essentially acknowledged that. And they don't. I don't think they use climate change. They use changing climate. And I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. But they acknowledge that this is all happening, but it's too late to do anything about it. So why change course, essentially? I don't know if that's kind of where your question is going.
Yeah, because if you go to a place like, so I've gone to St. Augustine my whole life. I've lived in the same place my whole life. And if you go to a place like Roanoke every year for 65 years, you kind of see over time.
Yeah.
Certain things start to change some of those benchmarks, like those waters are higher during the rising tide. And so, I don't know. I have noticed this trend with Republicans, and you are a former – you're one of the original employees of the EPA. I mean, that was your
Absolutely.
First.
I began working there when I was when it first opened its doors. I was a student in Houston at Rice and was an intern at the regional office that opened in its very first year.
So if you want to hear more about Rob's background, that first series, first episode in the series, sometime I think around March was a lot about that. But yeah, I've noticed that Republicans, so I've been tuning into Rush Limbaugh lately just to kind of, I'll tune into Limbaugh, I'll tune into Hannity, I'll tune into Alex Jones, see what these people are saying. And I have noticed, I heard Rush say the other day, you know, the climate is changing, but we don't know if it is man-made. And that is a far cry from about 5 years ago when it was, this is just a complete hoax.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, and I think it's very hard, you know, it's hard to deny most of this. That issue of man-made, and, you know, from the scientist standpoint, it actually seems to be settled more and more that humans, and, you know, think about how many billion people there are on this planet, and all of the output and all of the industrial activity it takes to support all of humanity. And it would be insane to think that we are not having an impact on climate. You know, we see our impact on the face of the planet itself, you know, the things we move and the things we build. So it would make just common sense. And
the complete change of the beef industry and that's effect on you know, not just the cow farts, but also just the land that it takes to support that. But then you start burning all of the palm trees to get palm oil in Indonesia and some of these other places. And then lo and behold, you go up to see video of the North Pole and it's got soot all over it. And that's what's heating up.
Yeah.
That's what's accelerating all this. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know much about climate change, but there does seem to be.
Well, and we are a very close short distance here to the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. My wife is on their advisory board. And in fact, when we were building this property here, we went to them for a forecast. And their forecast was that in the next 50 years, and I wanted to build a property that my children and grandchildren could use in the next 50 years, it's going to rise by X number of inches. So, you know, you really have to buttress yourself. And then the other thing you have to think about is all these people who can't do anything about it whatsoever. So just south of here is Norfolk, which is right on the water. And the military has huge facilities there. A year ago, I was invited to attend a conference put on by the military on, they could not call it climate change. It was called the effect of changing climate on military readiness and support. And there was a holdover Assistant Secretary of Defense, a woman who was very, very good, who pointed out that use of that phrase, changing climate. And the military has essentially been forbade for ideological reasons in the administration to be able to publicly talk about and make plans around what they know is happening, which is that their facilities are threatened by the rising tides. And in Norfolk, the tides go over the seawall and flood the streets periodically, far more than they used to. A similar effect down in Miami. And some of these cities have the wealth inherently to be able to deal with that, but not all do. You know, if you're an island out somewhere in the Pacific and you're gradually being swamped, one day there's going to be no island and you don't have an alternative. So
Venice, for instance, 150 days out of the year, they have to put up ramps, walking ramps, because there's
that's
just
right.
Because now
but
there's nowhere to walk.
But I do think this is a military, you know, this is a defense issue, and they recognized that 5 or 10 years ago. I, you know, of all the institutions in Washington that don't get enough due for reasons of their inherent worth, I think the military is one of those. My experience over the years, and remember, I came of age during Vietnam, and so everybody sort of hated the military, and a lot of my friends and others who were vets came back, and, you know, they were kind of reviled because the war was so reviled. Today, people have a very different attitude, and the military itself is really one of the most they're one of the most self-critical in a positive way organizations I've ever seen. So they really take seriously issues like climate change. You know, they have to worry about whether they can get supplies to the ships or the ships in the docks or whether the docks are going to disappear, all of those kinds of things. So I do think that's one of the inherent contradictions between the ideological part of the Trump administration and sort of the rational part. And then likewise, the swamp, which a lot of the military would be considered the swamp because, you know, these guys spent their careers developing an expertise and they do it on behalf of their country and they're not worried about ideology. They just worry about outcomes. So
let's break out and let's talk about some of the more sadder subjects, to be honest. Yesterday, yeah, there was a tragedy in Pittsburgh. Where was it? 11 people, I think I saw
11
last.
11 people killed, a number injured. Yeah,
at a bris, where it was at a synagogue. It was a child naming ceremony, an infant naming ceremony, and a gunman walked in. And this person had a profile on a social network called Gab, which is
right.
I'm a free speech absolutist, and I have been on Gab, and it's disgusting. it's as gross as the media says it is, and that's part of the problem. We'll talk about free speech later this week, but you know, he says he's not a Trump voter, he's not someone who supported Trump, but he's clearly on Gab. He's motivated by anti-Semitism. And then the day before that, or a couple days before that, the attempted. I mean, I guess we could call him a bomber. He wasn't very good at bombing. He just sort of was like, well, what would go in a bomb? And then just, I don't know, strung. He didn't even Google it, didn't see.
But, you know, the Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, said these are real bombs.
Right. No, they're filled with explosives. They were filled with, it was the, it's kind of what, it's pyrotechnic, I think, is what I heard reported, what you'd put in fireworks. Yeah. So they were actually dangerous. He seemed like, he seems like that guy. Everybody has one of these people in their town where he's rolling around in the van with the crazy stickers all over the place, and you're just like, yeah, that guy's got a screw loose. We'll give you more details on him on Tuesday, and as well as the Pittsburgh shooting. And I saw in Meet the Press this morning, there was a black couple killed in somewhere in the Midwest, and the guy in a Kroger, because he was trying to get into a black church and couldn't get in because of security, to basically shoot up this church, and he was motivated by hatred towards African Americans. So, you know, we have these three instances of violence coming from, I'm not going to say the right, because these people, all three of them, seem to be fairly unstable, and just because they have Trump bumper stickers, it doesn't mean that they're motivated by politics. And I would say the same about the guy who said he was motivated by Bernie Sanders and the left when he shot up the baseball diamond.
Well, they're more motivated by pathologies than they are necessarily by politics, I think is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, watching the Sunday shows, you and I watched the Sunday shows practically together this morning. And it's all about how the rhetoric is all Trump's fault. But of course, you have these instances of Eric Holder and Hillary Clinton and some of the people on the figurehead. It's amazing to watch Joe Biden have the lack of self-awareness where he's preaching a politics of change at McCain's funeral. And then 3 weeks later, he's, you know, we got to kick him when he's down type of rhetoric towards Trump. And but there is, it's just this, that's a cognitive dissonance for another day. But you and I both know, having watched a lot of campaigns, but a lot of our listeners have never followed campaigns. This is the first one where they're really paying attention to a campaign. And the month before, especially the 2 weeks before, things get really hot, and it's only going to get hotter as we move forward. And there's a big discussion about how dangerous and violent the rhetoric is in politics today. You know, and I'll be honest, I watch a lot of this and I go, it's not that much more heated than it was during the 2004 elections. It's probably less in some ways. It is easier to pin it on Trump because he's so outlandish. But I've done a fair bit of history, reading about the history of the 60s and the civil rights movement. And those were instances where you had entire groups of people just beaten because of politics. You had, I read at one point, I think it was in one of the, I think it was Taylor Branch's book, it was like 10,000 bombings or something crazy. Yeah. It was like an enormous amount of political bombings in the United States that I was just surprised.
That period was, having lived through that period, so I was born in 1950 and I went to college in 1968, which was kind of a peak of the anti-war protests. But, you know, before that, in the early 60s, you had all of the racially driven protests. You know, Birmingham used to be referred to as Bombingham.
Right.
Horrific bombing in 1963 of a church, racially motivated. There were thousands, as you say, of kinds of incidents, not just in the South, across the country.
The Weather Underground?
This was pre-Weather Underground, because this was actually during the early 60s. A lot of it was racially motivated. As you moved into the late 60s, when I went to college, it was the Weather Underground. And you know, it was anti-Wall Street. There were 8 bombings in New York City on Wall Street in 1969, carried out by kind of the left. And I will tell you, in college, and I'm sure, I don't know how many of your listeners are my age or close to it, but, you know, we would have classes suspended because someone would call in a bomb threat. And this was at Rice University in Houston. Rice, which is not particularly liberal, it's not liberal. I mean, it's intellectually liberal and in other ways, but I mean that in the broad-minded, you know, open to new ideas kind of thing.
Right.
It didn't have a political point of view, but and in Texas, I'm sure it was considered left-leaning, but we were 300 and some acres behind a hedge. We had just integrated, I think, in 1967, and that had caused its own set of issues. And I remember vividly the campus being shut down at one point because people were afraid that there were racially motivated attacks going to come across the hedge. And but classes would be called off because of a purported bomb threat and so on and so forth. And, you know, my wife, who went to Sweetbriar College in southwestern Virginia, which was a woman's college, then one of the 7 Southern Sisters, And by the way, how times have changed. Most people did not would not know that today that the University of Virginia and some of the other public institutions did not admit women. Duke did not admit women. Princeton, Harvard, Yale did not admit women to as late as 1967, 68, 69. So, you know, if you were a Southern, intelligent Southern woman, you had to go to something like that. You could have gone to Virginia Tech. My mother went to Virginia Tech back in the 40s. So I know it was, they allowed women then, but UVA did not, Duke did not, and nor did the Ivies. But my point was, she had a bomb call in out there in the middle of Nowheresville, you know, near Lynchburg, Virginia. You look it up on a map. So the whole climate was scary. I mean, I think we, all of us in the 60s, really wondered what on earth was happening to society. You know, we had, of course, the Kennedy assassination in 63, but then you get to the election in 67, 8, 9, you know, had the Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King. We had, well, Malcolm X was assassinated. And there were political assassinations then, which we have fortunately not gotten to yet here. Although we had Gabby out there in New Mexico or Arizona, I can't remember. Someone tried to kill her. This is not the first time we've been through it. In some ways, it's not. It doesn't feel as bad to me as it felt then. I would say that the rhetoric was very different then, and the velocity of words was slower, because all we had was television and radio and newspapers. And there was no internet, of course. And computers were still using big reams of paper. Those were the days when, if you're going to do a computer program, you did it on an IBM 1620 or some other, well, Rice had its own computers they'd built. But, and you would put your code on what Hollerith cards, these little cards, and type it in a big clunky machines and put it in a shoebox and race it down and before midnight, and they would batch process everything and get big sheets of paper telling you what was different. So that was what it was like. So the velocity of everything is different today, whether it's computers or media or language. And
literally every person, anytime anything ever happens on a daily basis, feels that they need to make a public statement about it. I mean,
Everybody knows about it within seconds.
Yeah, and so people feel that they're their own PR department, and so we feel we have to go on Twitter and make a comment about the shooting or the bomber or whatever. Like, we all have to denounce it or embrace something or support something, and it's all kind of virtue signaling is a term that has kind of popped up in the last 2 or 3 years. You know, and it is. It's a lot about social proof. Am I in the in group or am I in the out group? And do I wear being in the out group as a badge of honor? And yeah, so it is. It is a situation where everybody's talking about everything, and usually from a very ill-informed place. And from a, you know, if you read Jonathan Haidt's book on religion and politics and why it the Righteous Mind, that's what it's called. He basically is like it. Twitter is essentially just apes grunting at each other. It's just impulse comments. And so, yeah, it does feel very volatile. But when you look at the 60s, where you had major figures being assassinated, you had,
we had race riots. We had
the Watts riots.
We had anti-Vietnam riots. We had, you know, we went from race riots to anti-war riots and all of that. Now, the other thing that I do think, and this does not excuse, we should not excuse any of this at all. I do think this is not a criticism of Trump, of which we have many on this show, his reaction to me, he was asked a gun control question either this morning or yesterday, and his response was, I think if these people had been able to have a guard in the synagogue, that this might not have happened. And of course, that's been read to say, as Trump's first statement was about guns. And I am no fan, as you know, but that was not his first, that was a leading question. And of course, it's been recontextualized in the media, I think, and in a way that's not.
That's a good way of saying really propaganda. Accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not exactly right. They probably shouldn't do that. But I think the other question is really, how much can you do about this? The reality is we have, what, 340, 50 million, 60 million people now. And if 1,000th of a percent of the population is criminally pathological and wants to do something like that, that is still 360,000 people.
Yeah.
So every one of those is magnified beyond its particular meaning to something else. And of course, people are sort of right that language and rhetoric and the politics, I think, has an effect, but I don't think it's causal necessarily.
Well, yeah. People have this feeling that if someone disagrees with me, it's violence. Like, everybody's a little too sensitive.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I'm sure I've told you the story before that my kids, I think millennials, you millennials have a different view of things. But when my kids and I would get into some form of disagreement when they were younger, and I'm thinking I'm just being intense, they're saying, stop yelling at me.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, if I were yelling, you would know it. But I do think some of these things are hard to. It's all very hard to grasp. It's all terrible just in and of itself. But I have to say that I think the '60s were a much more terrifying period for Americans. It felt as if it was complete political instability, racial divides, economic, the war tore people apart. I think a lot of our differences today are more magnified than they in fact actually are. And they're magnified in a way makes them it's convenient to handle things as being left or right.
Yes, it's very simple. The internet is very simplistic. For as in depth as you can go on a show like this, social media is everybody's just so like. There's a joke on the show that I work for during the daytime that Charlie Daniels is blind and that Roy Orbison is blind, and it's just purely silly because they're not blind. And I'll get these letters like, I researched this for 3 hours and you're giving out false information. It's like, you're listening to a comedy show. It's a joke. Like, everybody's just so literal and straightforward. And so it's let me get it down to the most simplistic thing. And I think we're kind of being drugged down by the lowest common denominator, the people who can't think in a complex way.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So if you go back to the '60s, then obviously the '70s and '80s follow it. How did the country grow out of it? Was it just that the people who are the most radical grew up? Because the people who are the most radical right now are the Gen Z kids or the younger millennials, the kids who are in Antifa or all in their early 20s. I mean, do those people just grow up and change and, you know, they're Bill Ayers and all of a sudden they're friends with Obama on educational boards and, you know, and they just sort of over time change their stripes? How did the country grow out of that period and change?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I'm not a sociologist, as you know, but experientially, if you think back, there was actually a pretty strong response by society and leaders in society to try to actually deal with all of these various issues. So, you know, the response to Rachel Carson's book finally was the Environmental Protection Agency, and then we had reorganizations. Nixon was, for all of his many faults in Watergate, was the really first modern president and the guy to think about how to manage. We talked about this once before, that OMB, Office of Management and Budget, used to be a whole bunch of people managing and trying to do best practices across the government. And now it's mainly bean counters. So there was a real attempt for society to actually address some of these questions. You know, I think affirmative action, love it or hate it. These were people trying to figure out, what do you do about this? And I think that some of the more radical forces on left and right became isolated enough that that you could actually extract from that isolation what the actual issue was and try to deal with it. The war essentially ended in Vietnam, and, you know, Nixon ended that in 19, 73, I guess, was when we finally pulled out, for something like that. There were other exogenous things going on, you know, with the moon launch. We landed on the moon in 68. People forget that. And that was considered a massive, that was such a national boost in ego and feeling of accomplishment in the midst of all this other stuff going on. 69, I guess that was. So I do think that society reacted by trying to address issues. And I think, in fact, that life is a lot better for most people today, not saying it's what it should be for everyone, but there does seem to be less an ability among the political class to try to figure out how to split the difference and move ahead at least 3 feet if you can't move ahead 10 feet. And that is this, you know, this political polarization that we've been talking about a little bit. But the irony that those 60s kids are my generation. And when you look at who votes today and who votes relatively conservatively and who is voting for Trump, a lot of those people are the people who grew up in that period. So now many of those are not the radicals. And they remember, the radicals then were a small group on either side. They just caused a lot of, you know, a lot of noise and dislocation periodically. You know, there is a whole category of people who are Vietnam veterans or families who were affected by that, so on and so forth. So I think you're right. People do grow out of it, but it is ironic that that generation is probably the more conservative voter set today. The one that, you know, free love and free marijuana, you know, in the 60s.
Well, I wonder, I think there are definite contractions, and it mirrors just the, yeah, in an individual's life, you know, where I'll get too far ahead of my skis and then crash and then go, whoa, I need to get my senses together. I need to get a grip, and I need to focus on what's important. And I feel like we're headed towards that moment where we're having a collective, we are not these people, and everybody's kind of looking for change. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, a growing number of independents and people, yeah, looking for different options. And I really do feel like we're on the brink. I look at it kind of optimistically in some ways, that we're on the brink of, we're having growing pains, just like the 60s. You had growing pains as you brought women and minorities into society and gave, you know, stop using the government to prevent them from having freedom, I guess is the way to put it. I feel like we're in the middle of a massive change in the workforce, in the way that we communicate, in every aspect of our life. And so there are a lot of growing pains right now. But on the other end of that, you end up with a society that has worked some kinks out. And so people are starting to think more independently.
Well, and on a political side, there's an awful lot of data. You and I were talking earlier about this polarization, the country split down the middle. We have, you know, it's 40, probably 49 to 47 and a couple points in the middle and one side or the other. And I'm guessing that if you sort of numerized everybody and their points of view, what you would find is that people agree with each other, and Pew has done some research here, and we might be able to get some of that data for our next session. But what you'll find is that most people find themselves just a few inches away from the center on everything and can accept or agree within some boundary with about 90% of everyone else. And the problem is that that doesn't make for very good winning politically. To win politically, you got to get people to say, I'm on this side or that side. So to me, I think there's an aspect of this so-called polarization, which is not real. I think it's man-made. And I don't mean that in the way that they would say that it's rhetoric and everything else. I think it's man-made in the sense that you have to divide in order to win.
I'll tell you exactly, and go ahead if I'm cutting you off.
No.
Okay.
No, just a thought.
Just a editor's note, when you wrestle with the mic, we can hear that, so just be aware of that. doing this show, and I've worked in radio since 2004 and politics or radio. And so when you're doing media, when you're doing anything that builds an audience or you're trying to grow a community, there's two ways to do it. You can just do the hard work and grind and be very thoughtful and very detailed and produce a product that nobody else is doing. Or you can be kind of outrageous and get attention for yourself and be a flash. And what I've learned over time is that flash will always get you a bigger audience quickly, but it doesn't last because it eventually destroys you. I think the way to look at this is like Tommy Lauren or Milo Yiannopoulos. Those people are inherently more exciting for people to watch. There's always a lot more eyeballs on them. But at the end of the day, it's not as exciting as maybe a maybe even a Tom Woods podcast or something. So when you're looking at how to do, and if you listen to every episode of We Are Libertarians, you hear this over the years. We've gone back and forth between, all right, let's do the cheap and easy sugary diet type of broadcasting, or let's feed you a proper meal that's going to make you a healthier person. And so there's always that tension, I think. And that's part of what people love Trump, because Trump is reality TV. But Mitch Daniels is what you really need in government. And Mitch Daniels is so boring, not Donald Trump,
that's right.
You know? And so what plays in media is not centrism. Like, you roll your eyes at Michael Smirkanish, you love to laugh at Donald Trump, you know? It's a lot of it I place on not just corporate media, but what we choose to consume. We're training the behavior of politicians, media, corporations by what we choose to actually consume in any area. And so that's a big part of the problem. So yeah, I agree. I think most people, if they have a conversation with each other, they agree on a ton of things. You know, treat people fairly, don't steal their stuff, you know, but that's not good TV. And so
I think
is a huge part of the problem.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned the so-called boring politicians. I do think we've talked about this before. One of the big ironies, and you know, the title of this is Drain the Swamp. One of the big ironies here is that there's not a lot of draining going on, because there are not a lot of Trump people in office yet, because they haven't nominated most of them. So the government is still being run by the professional swamp denizens. So in some respects, fortunately.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about midterms, or should we ask that question about the swamp and then talk about?
I guess one question. Either way, I'm happy to go however you want to go.
All right. Let's segue into the swamp, and then we can do our midterm predictions towards the end here.
Yeah.
You are a prognosticator of foremost ability. So I want to make sure that we get you on record in case we don't talk before the election. So. Ryan Lindsay in the Facebook group, and if you're not in our Facebook group, please go join it. And while you're visiting wearelibertarians.com to find that link, make sure that you sign up for all the other social networks in case we disappear. Ryan asks, has Trump had any meaningful effect on the swamp?
Yeah. So that's a good question. And you have to divide it, in my view, into two parts. One part is there's just a whole lot of function that the government has to undertake. They've got to get out Social Security checks. They've got to run the Defense Department. They have to see that various institutions function, that student loans get, you know, dispersed, that they get collected, and so on and so forth. Fortunately, that stuff kind of runs on its own. Then there is the other side, which is the big policy part. And there's no question that in certain areas where Trump has taken a strong personal interest and has really put his people in place, you are seeing big changes, whether it is in our approach to the Iranians or to the Russians or to China or to trade or to neighbors to the north or south or any of those things. There's no question that his appointees have changed the dialogue, and in ways that make a lot of people uncomfortable, and which many view as destructive. But if you if you're like me and you like to see change, you probably like some of it and you don't like some of it, and you may be disgusted by all of it and have a problem. So on some things, the swamp is being drained, but that's not really the swamp, how we deal with the Chinese. I alluded to it a minute ago, the big issue for Trump in getting control of the swamp is that in order to do it, you really have to have people running departments and agencies. So, you know, there are roughly about 700 political executive branch positions that have to be nominated by the president and then confirmed by the Senate. About a little over half of those have been nominated and gone through the Senate process and are in place. And another quarter have been nominated, and another quarter have not. And that means that to just under half of all of the positions across the government, that, you know, that includes cabinet secretaries and deputy and assistant secretaries and agency heads and you know, the number of government agencies is mammoth. And they have to be, the only way you can change their direction or drain the swamp, if you want to call it that, is to actually put people in place to do it. You know, you just can't wave a wand. So looking at Trump's kind of priorities, about three quarters of the political positions have been filled in defense, about three quarters in education, health and human services, about two-thirds in Homeland Security, which in my opinion is hugely critical, and only two-thirds in Veterans Affairs. And of course, you know, he's been emphasizing all that, and he doesn't have all the people in place to manage what are huge budgets. Where he doesn't care so much, agriculture, state, treasury, labor, interior, and the Justice Department, it's half or less. And then if you start at EPA, only 40% of the people who the political appointees have been approved, and another 20% have been nominated. And, you know, if you want to change the law and the rules and regulations, you actually have to have someone there who knows what they are, who can pinpoint them, and who can say, let's rewrite or change this. And so is he really draining a swamp? I think probably not. I think there are some visible things that are not yet fully done, and they won't be because they have failed to do the number one thing a chief executive of any organization needs to do, which is to put his team in place. So the answer is no, I don't think he's draining it very much.
Look, before you say that, I just have to say I love the sound of ending government through attrition. Like, well, so you tell me why it's a bad thing, because I'm sitting here going, this is great, but it is also an issue that libertarians, Gary Johnson got elected in 2016, you're looking at the same problem, and like you're looking at, you know, but why is it a problem when there isn't actually somebody in those positions? Because what I hear, oh, okay, that means there's less people, you know, in these organizations that are frankly getting government paychecks from my tax dollars and doing less, and people have to justify their phony baloney jobs, so they take action. And when there's less of those people, then there's less bureaucracy, there's less regulation, there's less of everything. So, what's the problem here? What am I missing?
There's no regulation.
Hold on, Rob. You're going to have to say that again.
No less bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is work every day. So this is there is not less regulation, and there is not less bureaucracy, for the simple reason that the bureaucracy is in place. These are professional civil servants. They go to work every day. They manage the same programs every day that they have been managing for 20, 30, 40 years. Under regulations that were written in the Obama administration and the Bush administration and Clinton administration and on. And unless you can change the regulations, that's the job. That's the guideline. A government today is run by regulations. The regulations tell the government what it has to do, not just what we out here in the countryside have to do. So if you don't like the labor regulations, they are identifying and have identified Obama-era labor regulations that this crowd doesn't like, and they're publishing changes that eliminate them. But by and large, most of everything is still in place, as are the people administering it. And they can do some visible things. Interior, for example, can de-designate certain parks and things like that. But by and large, there's very little that has changed because they don't have the capacity, the manpower to actually do it. And that's because they have not made the appointments in place for people who have the same point of view. Now, in the defense of the bureaucracy, bureaucrats know that their job is to reflect the inclinations of whatever the current political administration is within the rules of law. And so the way it works is you have an assistant secretary and he wants to change a rule under the law. He works with the bureaucracy. He says, this is where we want to go. They, being good civil servants, help him write it in a way that stays within the law. Or if he says, I don't like that, they'll actually help him write a new law to send to the Congress where they will rewrite it. But you don't have much of that happening. Because they have failed, this administration has failed in its number one job, which is to put people in place to execute its vision of government.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes total sense. You have to have people in there actually going, hey, there's a problem here, we need to fix this, as opposed to just letting it rot on the vine. That's, yeah.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. Yeah, you were telling me about how this came up as we were talking a little bit about Khashoggi.
Khashoggi, right.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you work in the Middle East, and that kind of led to some of this. So can you tell us a little bit about your experiences working in Middle Eastern countries?
Oh, well, one of the companies that we started is a company that uses technology to optimize and manage the movement of trucks to and from ports. And we began in Jordan, actually, about 15 years ago. Another organization on the board of which I sit, the Northern Virginia Technology Council, about 20 of us business executives and 100 government officials sat down to a lunch with the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, who was then fairly new in the job. And I happened to sit next to the ambassador from Jordan, who was a serial technology entrepreneur, and we had a great conversation. I ended up getting invited over, and the government, U.S. government, this is where they can do good things, was trying to encourage investment in that country, in Jordan, which is an ally and has been supportive of the U.S. ever since its founding. And so we founded a company that we found a 6-kilometer line at the port of Aqaba, which is their strategic port of trucks. And these trucks were moving at about an inch a minute or every other couple minutes using, clutch and all of the rest of that. So it's very tiring. And it would take 18 hours or more to get to the gate. We put in a system that basically eliminated the line by telling trucks when they should arrive. So if you've ever been in an airplane flying from one city to another and you're on a schedule, sometimes you just sit there longer than you think and they put you in the air. And what's going on is there's a technology operating there that's trying to make sure that your plane lands at your destination exactly as another plane pulls out of a slot. And if you run into a thunderstorm and you go around it and you're delayed by 5 minutes, that slot you had rolls over to someone else and you get the next one. And these things happen automatically. And, you know, if you end up circling in the air, that's a failure of the system. It wastes fuel. You have to dump it. et cetera, et cetera. So we do that with trucks. And some years ago, the Iraqi government approached us because we, you know, the line is gone. There are no lines in Jordan. And for every dollar we take out in fees and revenues, that creates $20 of gross domestic product for Jordan by increasing the velocity of their transportation and business. And we're now doing that in Iraq. And, you know, Iraq is a very difficult environment. It took us 7 years to get everything up and running, and all that's going well. And as I was telling you also, Chris, we're losing about $2 million a year right now. The transportation minister there is diverting about 1 in 4 of our trucks, and we get paid for every truck that goes through the gate, and all 100% are supposed to go through it. But now they've just had elections. And so we believe that the new government is going to be less corrupt than the old one. Kind of the way this is, you know, and of course we're looking at Saudi Arabia as a potential place to go, and other countries across the Middle East and North Africa. And political stability is something you do want to see. And this Khashoggi thing has, I think, probably affected all of that. You know, it was I understand the conference over in Saudi Arabia so was obviously less well attended by named people, and I think it companies will keep doing business, but it's under a cloud, and you know that and that country is not quite, it's not in the least bit democratic. Jordan has elections, Iraq has elections. They've just finished their third election post-war, and they have a new government, and it's a technocratic government. I mean, even the Iranians have elections. they don't get to pick who gets to run. Actually, the mullahs have a veto, but even there, the election outcome is not always predictable. So there is a form of democracy going on there where people are able to express their opinion.
I mean, it's not like we have that much of a different system. You kind of like the choices in November were pre-selected by parties, and I don't mean people who went to primaries. I mean, you know, here in Indiana, it's a guy named Bob Grand who runs the biggest law firm in the city. Like, he's the one who's really choosing who's going to control the state. I mean, so it's,
we're a bit more free than all those countries.
We can still elect Donald Trump. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, that's right. And believe me, he was not picked by the leadership of the country.
No, that's for sure. Yeah,
he was picked by the vagaries of the Electoral College,
right?
And 47% of the population. So, and that's the way it works. You know, we have a government in Turkey. In Turkey, the Erdogan government, I think, has now won 3 elections. The first one, maybe 4. The first one, they only had about 35% of the vote. But the way they work there is that unless you hit 10%, if I recall, I think it's 10%, all of those votes get thrown out, and your votes get dispersed among the other political parties. And enough of those happen that they were able to get over the 50% line in the first election, even though they only received 35% or so. And then the second election, they had more because, of course, they controlled the political levers. And then by the third election, they controlled all the levers, the press, which is no longer free there. So different form.
Yeah. They, but boy, when the press isn't free in Saudi Arabia, do they make a noise?
Yeah. Now, one thing I will say, you know, this is about the swamp, right? And
yeah,
the draining it and then explaining it and the explaining part of this. So when we ran into these issues in Iraq with the government and a government minister, I had no problem at all contacting the people in the department, the United States Department of State, and the ambassador, and giving our story. And they all became advocates. And the ambassador to Iraq and the ambassador to Jordan, and the one became the other, the ambassador to Jordan later became the ambassador to Iraq, and now he's in the private sector. These are people who are actually professional State Department civil servant equivalents. They are people who have built their careers there. And in certain in certain instances, you want to have people who actually know what they're doing, as opposed to are there because they gave the president $1 million and want the social cachet of being an ambassador. So in places like the Middle East, those are professional ambassadors. And that is the swamp that, you know, everybody complains about. But I will say, as a business guy, I am very thankful that these guys were there. This one in particular, Stuart Jones, is just fabulous, and his successors have been great. And they will sit down and listen to you directly, and they bring their staff in, and they will follow up, and they have done it consistently. And you know, we've actually been able to work with the Iraqi ambassador to the United States, three of them. And the problem is there has been a corrupt transportation minister. Everybody knows he's corrupt. There's only so much you can do about it. And now we have in Iraq a new government, which is technocratic. It was elected. It took them 6 or 8 months after the elections to figure it out. But these guys are technocrats. I actually had someone, I think I can't tell you the name of the person because they'd like it to be confidential, but it's someone high in the Iraqi government who said it. If only the United States had pointed to these people and helped get them in office right after the war, so many things would be different. And who knows whether that's true or not. But anyway, it's just there are good things about having swamp creatures who know what they're doing stay put and do their job.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. I've just never met anybody who's actually like had to call an ambassador before. That's very fancy. Like, I'm just sitting here going, my life is so, I thought my life was complicated, but like you're calling ambassadors, and it's very, very, interesting. Like so when people say the American government is corrupt, like, yeah, you got the Clinton Foundation and stuff like that. But, like, do you kind of roll your eyes and go, all right, let's not overdo it? Because I've had business in Iraq.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think, you know, of course, there are different kinds of corruption. There's monetary corruption, and there is intellectual corruption, and there is political corruption and all of that. I don't think these people are any more corrupt necessarily. I do think there is a lot of naivete in the people coming with the administration, at least a lot of the early guys. You know, the Pruitt, who was the first EPA administrator, you know, he had made a name for himself in politics in Oklahoma by taking on the federal government. And he's a smart guy. I think, you know, a lot of problem people come to Washington and they really think they got to live like you know, the people they see around them, the lobbyists and everybody else. And they're supposed to be on a civil servant, you know, on a salary. So they're not big salaries. And it's expensive to live in Washington and even nearby Virginia and Maryland. But so I don't know if I think there's any more the monetary kind. I do think there's a kind that comes about because of naivete. And you know, I think I've told you before that I've known several politicians who've gone to jail for things that to me are incomprehensible. There was one guy whose wife I met when I ran for Congress in 1984. She and he are both lovely people, and he ended up in jail for padding his expense account, a couple hundred bucks here and there. Another guy I knew was the governor of Connecticut, and he ended up in jail for letting contractors work on his house. And of course, then, you know, Ted Stevens, who was a senator from Alaska, was convicted, although it was eventually overturned, for essentially the same kind of thing. So a lot of corruption comes about because people don't follow the rules that they may not understand. But I will say there are an awful lot of people in the swamp who are the ethics guys who will tell you if you ask what you can and can't do. You know,
well, that when I was helping candidates, it was like, here, so what are the FEC rules? I don't know, just don't do anything. Like, then you won't be
well, that's about right. Risk. Yeah. Well, the other thing is does it feel right? And now, so when I was maritime commissioner in the early 1990s, each of us had a budget. There were five commissioners, and I was invited to give more speeches than the entire commission put together times two, because I was trying to, you know, I was fairly radical about it. I was trying to abolish the agency and deregulate the industry and get rid of a bunch of these rules in the maritime industry, which we've talked about in other of these podcasts. And at some point, I ran out of my budget. And I just decided that I was not going to let these parties pay for my way. So I actually paid for my travel for the second half of the year each year, because I didn't want anybody to look at me and say, well, these are industry groups and they're paying for your way. And are you corrupt? You know,
right.
Or are you being bribed by lunch, a chicken lunch? Give me a break.
Right. All right. Let's ask the next question. This involves the Federal Reserve. Very libertarian question when it involves the Fed. Kenneth writes, what type of mingling actually happens between the politicians in D.C. and the Federal Reserve? We're told that it's a separate entity, but it sure seems not to be the case.
Well, they are. There are two different sets of things here. One is... there is a constant exchange of information between the bureaucracies of the Fed and other agencies like the Treasury Department. And they have to do that because, you know, they're buying and selling securities and all of these things. And there are a number of things which are required by law. At a social level, you know, these are people who live in Washington out of convenience because that's where their jobs are. And the chairman of the Fed always lives in the community. And we have certainly seen the last couple chairmen out and about in the community. And that's really what you want them to do. And by the way, they also have spouses who have their own jobs and their own social networks. And it would be really strange. It would be incredibly strange if these people were not allowed to go about having a social life in the community in Washington where all of these people live, right? They also reach out to the business community. I was in a meeting, invited to a meeting in, I think it was March or April, must have been late April. This Northern Virginia Tech Council on which I sit had invited the governor of the Richmond Federal Reserve, who was a new appointee, a business guy, and he had requested a meeting with technology leaders. So we had about 20 people in the room and a great lunch and a real free exchange of ideas. And some people would, you know, talk about this and that, and some would complain and some would compliment. But it's hard for me to think it's a bad thing for the governors to not take part in society on a regular basis. And it's hard for me to think it's a bad thing for them to not sit down to lunch and consult with business leaders about it.
Yeah, I think the underlying question here, the underlying concern is the idea that if you're friends with somebody or if you're acquaintances with someone or if you're supposed to be, you know, if you're Robert Mueller, the special investigative counsel, like you're never to have any kind of relationship with anybody who's involved in anything. So I think people have two conceptions of Washington, D.C. and government in general, is that everybody who draws a federal government paycheck is at a dinner party every night and meeting everybody else.
No.
No, I mean, I think a lot of people would be surprised if you talk to people who go and work in Washington, D.C. I've had a tremendous amount of friends go and work in Washington, D.C. over the years with congressmen, at agencies, now with the vice president. You know, they're at home on Friday night watching Netflix with their kids. It's a job to them.
And these people work incredibly hard. I'm sure I did tell that story when the president's chief economic advisor from Wall Street, Gary Cohn, said, what are the two big surprises? And he said, well, one of them is how hard people work. I am personally working harder now than I have since I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. And he, of course, is in his 60s. And the reality is it's a short-term job. If you're a political appointee or head of the Fed or any of these things, you know, you're there for 4, 6, 8 years at best. And most people are only for 2. And you work your tail off, as do all the people who work for you. because they're on your calendar and your time, and it doesn't matter, frankly, whether they're political appointees or civil servants. The high level civil servants work their ass off, just like the high level political appointees.
Yeah,
that's their job, and it is a job, and believe me, there are not a lot of parties. There are a lot of parties, but they're not like they used to be in the old days. You know, when I was first in Washington and had very little money, my roommates and I would make sure that we had at least two nights out where we would find some congressional or executive branch party that we could crash and fill in as extra numbers, because, you know, fundraisers and all these things, they never get the attendance they want, but they want to have what looks like a lot of attendance for whoever the speaker might be. And so it was no problem to walk into an event and say, oh, we're with so-and-so, and eat our fill and not have to pay. So it's not quite as much fun as it used to be.
The other myth that I would kind of say in the underlying, and no disrespect, I just think that if you have experience, like I have a lot of experience working around local and state government, and observing it here in Indiana, and a somewhat tentative view of Washington, D.C. as a result. And what you find is that I have a lot of friends. So I have a lot of friends who worked in the opposite party. I would go to lunch when I was the Libertarian Party executive director of Indiana. I would go to lunch with Republican State Party or Democratic State Party people, and you'd swap information and you'd talk to people and you'd find out. And it was essential intelligence gathering, but it was also a way for you to go, wow, this is a person. This is kind of the best time of any campaign season, you know, because the candidates go to debates with each other, and then these people that they have demonized for so long now are like people that they're having to talk to in a green room, and they're meeting their wives, and the campaign manager that they hate is actually like a nice guy. Yeah. And, you know, and so that humanization of each other, it doesn't mean that you change your positions. It means that you treat the other side a lot differently, and you have more of an open-hearted position as opposed to a hard-hearted position, which in life is just a better way to operate. It's much less intense, and it's really not a bad thing for people to get together and talk when they're competition, or even if it's there's supposed to be a wall there. You know, once you start getting into entangling financial alliances or whatever, but I think we make a bigger deal, those of us who are not in, you know, who are in the middle of the America and don't have a good view. We've watched West Wing, so we have like, that's what we think politics is, and right. Or House of Cards.
Yeah.
And so we have this view of how things work, but in reality, knowing each other and having a relationship is not a bad thing, and it doesn't inherently mean that there's corruption or that the truth and justice in the American way isn't being executed because they know each other.
Yeah, that's right. So, no more comments on it. I totally agree with you. And again, this also goes to this kind of artificial polarization, in my opinion, which is that most politicians would find more common ground if they were not whipped by their party whips and whipsawed by their newspapers and the local political parties into taking a hardline position on one side or another. We would have a lot more. We'd have a lot more getting done at the political level, probably, if we didn't have all of these artificial devices creating polarization.
What you see, and people smell it out, the authenticity, the inauthenticity. What you see in public, what you see on the Sunday shows, none of that's real. It's the conversations that you hear on this show or that you kind of assume or have. I mean, that's the reality. It's not the hardline position. So speaking of, I've got to ask you briefly about the Kavanaugh stuff. Because I wonder, A, if you've ever met him or been around him or what you thought of it, and also what was the environment like there in D.C. as all that was happening? Because that seemed to just light the city on fire.
Kavanaugh, yeah. I have never met him. I knew kids who went to his school, who were his class, who are now in their early 30s. The school certainly had a reputation, at least when my kids were there. You know, they didn't go to that school. They went to another private school. But when they were in high school, 15, 17 years ago, you know, the school, absolutely, these boys' schools had a reputation. So I will say it whipsawed everybody. My wife would not discuss it with me, nor would my daughter, because, you know, you can't, it's hard not to get into a conversation about it without having to take a kind of a polarized position. And my own view partly was that I know personally, I think, I don't think she was lying. And I think most people would say that, although I think having been, she was probably traumatized by the event and therefore it was magnified in some ways. And that's rational. I don't think he was lying in the sense that if he was the kid who was doing it, how on earth would you remember it 36 years later? And he was probably blottoed anyway, so he didn't remember it, even though he said he never got drunk like that. So I think both people are good people and all that. I think for personally, the thing that made me and many of my friends uncomfortable was his very kind of impolitic rebuttal at the end, an attack on the senators, which felt really out of place and really not very judicially tempered in the sense of a guy who's going to have to, at some point, review the laws that these very people have passed. It felt inappropriate. And that, I think, is why one of the retired justices came out and opposed him. On the other hand, I just went to my 50th high school reunion in Orlando, Florida, a class of 686 people. I have physically seen only two people from my class in all that time and maybe had email contact with three others only a handful of times. And I went back thinking about, oh, my God, do I know, am I going to know any of these people? And, you know, you have probably been to your 10th or 15th reunion, if that much. But we all walked around with name tags that had our high school photo on it and our name in big letters so you could read it. And people would reach down and look at your name tag 3 inches from their nose and they'd say, oh, I know you. And I know I did the same frequently. And even though I had not thought about or remembered any of these people in all of that 50 years or had contact, the fact that you knew them came flooding back, but you could not remember anything. I could not remember anything about any event except the semi-traumatic ones. Like there's a guy who I was friends with. He was president of one of the clubs. And my last encounter with him, he grabbed me by my shirt and said, stay away from my girlfriend, and threatened to clobber me. And I saw him there. And obviously he thought I was trying to make time with his girlfriend. And I saw him there and I said, hi, you know, we haven't talked. And my last recollection was this. And he said, really? I don't remember that at all. I can't believe I did it. And I remembered it. So, and he had ended up marrying her. So I think trying to remember what happened, even if you had a primitive calendar, 36 or 26 or 50 years, you know, earlier, is just, I think that's really problematic. So I think in the end, and I've noticed that a lot of the press, even the left side of the press, has been saying this, a couple people recently, it's that it really came down to kind of a due process question. These things may or may not have been true, but, you know, you can't prove it and you can't disprove it. And no matter what you do. So I think in the end, that's essentially what Susan Collins said. And she also made the point that the groups who oppose Trump and others, that they did put out a press release the morning of, before his name was even announced, with X's in the name because they didn't know who it was.
Right.
But this person that they were opposing was a terrible choice, an anti-American, and on. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch him. My sense is he is going to be more moderate than Neil Gorsuch, who was the last judge, and I don't think he'll be quite as centrist as the judge he's replacing, Justice, but I don't think he's going to be the winger that he's painted. So it'll be interesting to watch that. And now it's disappeared. And did it energize the base? That is yet to be seen. You know, we'll see in a very few days what's going to happen.
I think yes, but it is the polling for out there shows that people don't even remember that it happened. I mean,
that's right.
It's when people are like, this is going to swing the election for Trump. I'm like, there's two news cycles a day and we have 30 days. No, it won't.
And I think that's been swamped, as has been this so-called caravan out there, which I understand is now down to about 3,000 people. You know, the Mexicans are actually taking their applications for asylum and feeding them, and they're peeling off. And of course, it's still 1,000 miles away and moving at about five or six or seven, 8 miles a day, if that much. It's going to be interesting. I think the election is pretty much up in the air. I'm still kind of where I was before when we get to that part.
Yeah, well, we're there. I think that a lot of polls show that in some of the key congressional districts, Republicans are tightening the race. Mike Braun here in Indiana is tightening with Joe Donnelly. And, it's been quite the race to watch. My friend who lives in Florida, she just moved to Florida. So it's her first Florida election. And she's like, I can't take the mail anymore. It's insane. And so, it seems like a no holds bar. I think there's a lot at stake for the president. If the Democrats actually do retake the House by a significant margin, I think impeachment is definitely on the table. It's been on the table for every president, although not seriously for Obama since the Clinton affair. But you had a pretty good track record. You won quite a few bets with the Trump election and in 2016. So what are you thinking in terms of the midterms? Is there going to be a big blue wave?
Well, I don't think so. You know, I think I said last time that Charlie Cook said that the Republic, it's the wave versus the seawall, and that Republicans have built a very strong seawall in the congressional redistricting of the last two cycles, 20 years. And so the question is there going to be a wave, and will it be big enough to wash over the wall? And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a moderate wave, but I still don't see a really big animating story for the Democrats. I think some of these things have animated Republicans and in opposition geared up women voters and others in certain areas. But I'm still of the position that I'm going to be, I think my prediction is that Republicans will retain the House by a couple seats, and that we are likely to retain the Senate. If there's a big enough wave, though, I personally think the Senate is more likely to flip than the House, because the Senate, the way to think about that is the way the national elections worked in the presidential, which is that Hillary won by 3.5 million votes, but she didn't get around the tactical bulwark of the states and the congressional districts and the electoral college. And it's like that. So the Senate seats are all at large. And if there is a wave, they're more vulnerable to, a half a point or a 1 point or 2 point shift than a lot of these congressional districts. So now I know that all of the formal prognosticators are predicting it's a 3/4 probability that the House will flip. But I'm sticking to my guns. I would say further, if the Democrats do not win the House, it will be the best thing possible for them. And the reason, in my mind, is that that will then allow them to get rid of Congresswoman Pelosi, who I think is their biggest downside. They really have got to change generational leadership, and that is not going to happen if they win the House in this cycle.
I don't know about where you're at, but I've heard this is a nationwide campaign, but the Indiana State Republican Party every single day sends me a mailer saying that if Donnelly wins, then Pelosi wins. And I'm just sitting here going, Senator Donnelly is not going to be affected by House Rep Pelosi. Like, but yeah, it doesn't matter. Right. Her people don't know they don't know basic civics. And so you're getting a Schumer and Pelosi mailing piece from the Republicans every single day. So her polling just must be abysmal. I look at it.
I have seen some horrific ads though. And you know, there's this one guy, David Trone, who's a Maryland guy, who ran last time and lost to another Democrat. And I think he spent more money than any race in the country. He may still be doing it on this one. And I heard an ad that David Trone has a problem. He's been arrested 3 times, once for criminal, whatever the hell. And it's just unbelievable. I don't know anything about what it's about. And then, of course, he comes on with these happy dippy kind of ads about all of his accomplishments on the other side. And he'll probably win because it's a blue seat. But and then I'm hearing similar ones in the other direction against Barbara Comstock, who is a friend and who I like. And, you know, my big fear, given where I come from in the party, is that we will continue kind of the losing streak of moderates. You know, in the last cycle, all of the moderate Republicans in the Virginia legislature were kicked out, and that was a big loss. And my fear is that the people, many of those who are the most vulnerable today in this cycle, are moderate Republicans. So,
I mean, yeah, and moderate here in Indiana, moderate Democrats are Donnelly's on the hot seat. So, I think the Senate, the Republicans are going to retain it. And
I think that's probably right.
Yeah, I can't predict the House because I haven't dug into the individual districts and looked at the Cook political report and read what's going on. And it really matters what's on the ground. But I will say that the increased voter turnout, I think Trump has done a good job of convincing Republicans that every election from here on out is about survival. All of civilization depends on you winning this election. The conservative press, especially the fringy press, which is why the liberals are so eager to get rid of it, motivate Republicans by making them think that there's a crisis of their survival if they don't get out and vote. And, you know, I was talking to a Democratic friend on the House, and he was like, okay, yeah, right. The left controls everything. We're not in control. We're not in control of the Senate, of the House, of the courts, of the presidency. And I said, yeah, that should cause some self-reflection because you have the culture. You have the media, you have Hollywood, you have the universities, and yet you're not winning at the ballot box. And so they're easy. Instead of self-reflection, it's gerrymandering, which is a legitimate problem. But they don't understand that their version of politics is just not something that most Americans really want. As you saw with that Atlantic, I don't know if you saw the Atlantic identity politics survey, you know, and Fukuyama coming out against identity politics. And it's like 80% of Americans don't like what they're actually providing in terms of alternatives. They're not giving alternatives. They're saying he's bad, so vote for us and we'll be better. And it's like, no, we remember Obama and Clinton and we're not fans of that. So, all right. Well, I guess I've left you speechless.
You did. I completely lost your signal.
That's okay.
One of the problems of living down here. You might have to edit this little section for everybody.
Yeah, I might leave it in because anyway, it was kind of funny. I think Republican turnout's going to be really high. And then what's crazy is that what you're going to see from the left, if they don't win the House and the Senate, or if they win only one, it's going to be full scale. The Republicans stole this in Georgia. The Republicans stole this at the ballot box. They purged the voter rolls. They gerrymandered. It's like there is absolute truth to a lot of that. But at the same time, it is the same argument.
Absolutely.
It's the same argument that chilled me to the bone that Trump made. I'm not going to accept the results of this election. And Democrats just cannot accept that Hillary lost. They're not going to accept a loss here. They're not going to accept a loss if Trump gets reelected. And they're just kind of perpetuating their own crisis of democracy when they don't do their own level of self-reflection and go, maybe we are the problem. Maybe we're not offering good solutions. Maybe government's not the answer.
There are some, I do
Hello? I think we may have lost the signal here.
I don't know if you can hear me now, Chris.
Okay, there we go. Now you're back.
Got me again?
Yeah.
Okay, you got me?
Yep.
Says it's unstable.
Yeah, so just go right into your answer because we didn't hear anything that you said.
No, yeah, and I didn't hear anything in your question.
Okay.
But what I was going to say.
Basically, my question was.
I do think they're real questions. That this election.
Yep, there you go.
Okay, you hear me now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think the gist of your question, where I come from, is this election is going to be all about turnout. I think there are real legitimate questions in Georgia in some of these places. There's actually absolutely a conflict, and I don't mean to accuse the Republican in that race, but he is in a conflict position. He should have resigned a long time ago before he ran. It is about turnout. I don't think the Democrats have a lot of animating issues. I think you're right. Republican and Democrat turnout is going to go up. I think the big issue is, are there going to be more suburban women and that ilk, you know, and I mean that as a broad demographic, to come out? And that's going to be interesting. I mentioned the moderate Republicans. By moderate, I do mean people who are willing to try to talk to the other side and who are actually interested in making sausage, which is really what Washington is supposed to be about in the legislative process. So they're not moderate in a lot of issues. So can you hear me now?
Yeah, I heard all that. It was great.
Yeah, good. Feels like one of those phone ads, doesn't it?
Yes.
I'm wondering if let me know now when you're ready to talk about food. By the way,
that's I'm ready. I'm ready. I was just about to ask. So on the show, you know, everybody ends up visiting DC at one point or another. May be there in February for LibertyCon. I have not decided if I'm going to spend the money yet.
Well, but hopefully you're here before that.
Yeah, LibertyCon, I don't know if it's in January or February, but I love going to D.C., and D.C. has great restaurants, and nobody loves to eat and drink more than Rob Cortel. So we have a segment here on the show called The Diner's Guide to D.C., and so with that, without further ado, please explain to the folks what your recommendations for food, drink, entertainment are when they visit the nation's capital.
Well, what I'm going to do today is actually recommend that folks go to a website called Bib Gourmand, G-O-U-R-M-A-N-D. So the Michelin, I'm sure you've all heard of Michelin stars. Michelin, of course, gives stars to really highly rated restaurants, and we have a number of those in Washington. But for most people, what you really want to look for is what they call their Bib Gourmand, B-I-B-G-O-U-R-M-A-N-D. And they added 19 new restaurants in Washington to their list of 21 or so from the year before. So Washington is finally being recognized for having some really good and interesting food. And these are restaurants which are, by definition, affordable. You have to be able to order two courses and a glass of wine or dessert for $40 or less. And so, they include, a Filipino restaurant, Bad Saint, and, Chili Chilcano, one Chloe, which is fabulous down at the, waterfront. There's a vegan restaurant, Fancy Radish, just a whole lot of very interesting restaurants. So, you want to go to a website called DCIST.com/2018/09/bib_gourmand_2018_DC. Or just go to DCIST.com and look for Bib Gourmand, and that'll give you a really good starting place.
Excellent. Yeah, if you send me that link, I'll put it in the description, and then people can just go press the button.
We'll do it.
Yeah.
We'll do it.
All right. Very good. So any final thoughts on this episode for the folks out there in America?
I'm not taking bets on this election, but I am still predicting the houses will not change.
That's a bold prediction. We'll be looking.
Right. All right.
Rob, thanks so much. It's been great to talk to you. And then hopefully we'll get to talk here in the next couple weeks and do a little recap of what happened.
Dissect this next week.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we will talk to you soon. And thanks so much.
All right. Thanks. You have a good one.
Oops. All right. Cool.